What does possibility mean to you?
That's a hard question.
Something that you can strive for.
That I'm able to do anything I set my mind to.
You're confident in yourself and you believe in yourself. Stuff that you could achieve.
I feel excited. Anything is possible when you're more confident.
Shoes are a huge part of that. They are the most important part of my style.
You can like express yourself in the right shoes.
Anything is possible.
DSW, countless shoes at bragworthy prices. Imagine the possibilities.
Welcome in, everybody, to the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. I am pleased as punch that you joined us today, as we've got a very popular topic. Not just a popular topic, but popular amongst the true crime genre is serial killers. And one of those serial killers that everybody talks about, that everybody can't seem to get enough of, is Ted Bundy. And one of those people that is one of the utmost authorities on Ted Bundy, so much so that he's produced 6 books on Ted Bundy, is Kevin Sullivan. He's a good friend of our show. And he started a project here that's very interesting. I got a chance over the weekend to pick it up and spend some time with it and read it and kind of absorb it here. It's called Ted Bundy, The Early Journal, Volume 1, 2022. And I'm going to bring Kevin in now. Welcome in, Kevin, and welcome back to True Crime Tuesday.
Well, hi, Tim, and thanks for having me back. And as always, we'll be talking about Ted Bundy, and there's always more to learn about this man.
There is.
So thanks for having me back.
There is. And you know something, Kevin? I'm fascinated by the fact that, and you know, the last time you were here and Dave Schrader was hosting the program, he said something critical to you that I laugh as I pick up this now yearly journal, and we're going to get down to the reason here in a minute that you're writing a yearly journal. But he said to you, gosh, Kevin, there can't be much more to this Ted Bundy thing. Can there be? You've mined now 6 books on Ted Bundy. How much more can there be?
That's true. Well, just to bring the listeners a little bit up to date, if they're not as familiar with me, in 2009, my book, The Bundy Murders, A Comprehensive History, was published by McFarland. And in fact, they've done an updated edition. The Bundy Murders, A Comprehensive History, published in second edition, published in April of 2020. And that has some new information in it. But when I got into this whole thing with Bundy, it was never my intention to write more than the one book, because that is the full biography and that is the full treatment of his known murders and some suspected murders. But and I have to say this, that the book, when it was published in 2009, it had brand new information that had never been published before about 3 or 4 of the murders, and a lot of new information coming forth just in general about the case. And so that was published. And then, I'd been writing true crime. That was my first true crime book. And my first book before the Bundy murders was a personality study on George Armstrong Custer. And then in the years after the Bundy murders was published out, I wrote other things true crime related. And what's interesting, though, is that I never had any intention of going back into the case once that book was published. I thought it was going to be a one and done. I was very proud of it, because I knew I had people telling me before I wrote the book, don't write it, because there's been too much published about Bundy already. And I thought, yeah, well, but that was like, 15, 20 years ago. And I thought, I'm just going to go ahead with what I feel I need to do. And again, halfway through the book, I was finding out new things. Well, so the book was published. People started to learn who I was. And a few years after that, I had a lady author contact me, and she wanted to go in with me and maybe do a co-author with me a book on some of Bundy's maybe suspected murders. And at the time, I just didn't want to get back into the case. So I said, I knew we could have made some money and all that stuff, and she'd be a nice lady to work with. But I just thought, no, I just don't want to do it right now. So I just said no. But then around 2015, I heard that, one of my contacts had passed away a couple of years before then. And then another of my contacts, one of the former investigators, which was Jerry Thompson at the time, he was having problems with dementia and things like that, and he was kind of going downhill. And I thought, well, if I'm ever going to do a companion volume to the Bundy murders, I should do it now while people are still around. And I must say that I was really happy I did it, because I was turning up brand new information that had never been published before about Ted Bundy from some of those who knew him quite well. And that book was called The Trail of Ted Bundy, Digging Up the Untold Stories. And I'll never forget that one of Bundy's Mormon friends in Utah named Larry Anderson, and you'll see his testimony in The Trail of Ted Bundy. He was offered a lot of money from one of the tabloids several days after Bundy was executed. I mean, this is what he told me. And he said he never, they offered him all this money, but he didn't want to talk about it. So here I come along some 20-something years later, and he was aware that I had interviewed Carol Bartholomew and, did right by her. I've got a good reputation of always doing what I tell my contacts I'll do and not doing what I won't do. And I interviewed Carol, and if anybody, a lot of people have seen this picture, there's a really pretty blonde in a picture with Bundy, and it's like he's helping her do the dishes at a party in Salt Lake City, and he's like pointing the rinsing gun at her. Well, that's Carol Bartholomew, and I had interviewed Carol, and she's in the book, The Trail of Ted Bundy. And Carol, after I interviewed her, she gave me the name of Larry Anderson and John Homer, those other people that also knew Bundy well, just like Carol did. And so I remember Larry Alexander telling me that after he said he didn't take any money to do the story, he said, but for some reason, maybe it's because Carol, put in a good word for me, he said, I'll talk to you. And of course, he didn't charge me a dime, and I don't pay anybody for interviews anyway.
Right.
But his whole story's in there, and it's got some really interesting stuff. So that was another book. Well, then a book called The Bundy Secrets followed that. And I had new testimonies. These people, I guess I got such a name out there for Bundy, being associated with Bundy in the case, that valid people contact me. Now, there's a lot of people that contact me that I don't think are valid, and I don't publish their stories. But when I do find them and I can validate their story, I always use them. And so after The Trail of Ted Bundy was published, I thought, well, I'm not going to publish another book. But then here comes these testimonies, and they're lining my files. And so then I just go after that. Well, let's just do another book. And so we did. The publisher said it was a good idea. And that led to the following book, which was Ted Bundy's Murderous Mysteries with the yet again new testimony. And then I also like to, when I do these companion volumes, I'll print portions of the record that really people have never seen, and then have commentary on it, and then have other stories in there. But all these new testimonies. And then after that, a guy suggested that I write, I had a guy contact me one day right after Ted Bundy's, murders, mysteries were published. It's like 2 days later after that was done. And I like to take about a week after a new book comes out. Just kind of relax, not do anything, except for maybe some podcasts or radio shows or whatever.
Sure.
And then just relax. Well, this guy contacts me, a friend of mine on Facebook. He said, listen, have you ever thought about writing an encyclopedia of like the Bundy murders, the Ted Bundy case file? I said, no. I said, sounds like a good idea. But I said, do you realize I just published this other book? It just got released 2 days ago. He said, yes, I know. But he said, listen, here's what He said, I would do it myself, but I'm working on all these American Civil War projects and I just can't. And I said, well, you know what? Let's put that on the shelf. It does sound like a good idea, but let's put it on the shelf. And I'll get back with you if I use it. I'll certainly give you credit for bringing the idea to me. He said, okay. So a couple of days later, I contacted my publisher. I thought, well, so I'll just see what they think about it. Well, they like the idea. So then I did the Ted Bundy, the encyclopedia of the Ted Bundy murders. And so that was the fifth book, the fourth companion volume to, like you should say, the Bundy murders. And then after that, because of, again, new and valid testimonies coming to me, I wrote just, and I covered so many things in that book. But the last book, the sixth volume of that book, totaling, if you add all the books up, the pages, it's almost 1,500 pages. It's 184 pages. But that's a lot of writing to do on one case. And so the enigma of Ted Bundy came out and had some super interesting interviews with some valid Bundy contacts. So I thought, you know what? I'm done. I have to be done. I've written over 1,400 pages. Mm-hmm. It's enough. I'm done. Well, then people kept contacting me. And I think like in January of last year, I had three people contact me, and two of them turned out to be valid contacts after I did some kind of investigation on it and some double checking with other people and things like that. And one did not. The third one might have been, but she had gotten this information from her mother. She didn't quite know all the story, and her mother had passed away. So there's nothing I could do about it. But anyway, so I thought, well, you know, I said, I hate to keep gaining all these stories and not doing anything with them. I'll ask my publisher if they might be interested in putting out like a yearly journal and of these people to contact me and maybe some other aspects of the case that that we could look a little bit deeper at, especially at some of his other attempted murders and abductions that did not happen. So they said, yeah, we actually loved the idea. And I didn't know that they would. So when they said yes, I thought, well, I'll do this. And so I'll tell you something. And I'm going to tell you something about this latest book, this seventh book, but it's the new series called Ted Bundy, The Yearly Journal. And this is volume one. I had something be presented to me, which can only be considered accidentally presented. It's like, it's nothing I was looking for. It's nothing anyone ever touched on because nobody ever knew it. And yet because of one testimony from a woman named Susan Milner that came out in the Enigma of Ted Bundy, the last book, and the new testimonies that came out in for this new journal, I was able to find out what Ted Bundy's hunting pattern was for the first month he was in Utah. Now, let me explain about that. He arrived in Utah on September 3rd, 1974. And of course, he had to like start school, like enroll and touch base with them. He also had to fly home in the middle of the month and get a truck because he had come there on the 3rd with his Volkswagen and with just stuff he could pile in the car that he needs in his apartment. Mm-hmm. But he had to fly back home in the middle of the month. He got his brother Glenn. He already had purchased an old truck. I think can't remember who he purchased that from. But anyway, he purchased this old truck, and Glenn and he unloaded all his furniture from his apartment in Seattle on 12th Street, and then they drove it back. And you can see the places they stopped for gas because, you know, later the investigators did their gas receipts and all that stuff on Bundy, and they could track him. So he gets back there. I mean, Glenn helps him unload all that. I don't know if he spent any time there with him or not, but he ended up flying back to Seattle. And so, you know, Bundy was really busy. Well, it turns out that And this came out in Enigma that Susan Milner, and of course, Bundy lived in an area called the Avenues in Salt Lake City. And it was fairly close to downtown. And it was just, but the Avenues would, you know, roll right into the downtown, as it were. But Susan Milner came to Utah. She was married in the temple there on September 10th of 1974. So Bundy had just been there about a week. But later that month, she said she had a little argument with her husband. And she said it was either, she believed it was late September. She said it could have been in October, but I really think it's like late September. And so she walked a few blocks from her apartment, just wanted to be alone a bit. And she said she went into a schoolyard and got on a swing, and the road is right next to it, but there's a fence because it's a schoolyard. And Bundy pulled up in his Volkswagen and asked her, came in, he was leaning on the fence, you know, very polite, and asked her if she'd like to go for a ride. She said no. She said, I was mad at my husband. I'm certainly not going to go out with any other guy. And so he just kind of waited a second, and he asked her again. He was trying to get her to go with her. And she said, no, I can't. So he just kind of tapped the top of the fence a couple of times and okay, and got back in his vehicle and left. Well, once his picture was shown, okay, and she's about, like I say, she was about three blocks from where he lives. She said, well, that's Bundy. Okay, so I consider that to be a valid contact. Well, for this book, these people that contact, I was able to record the stories of two young women that lived together about five blocks from Bundy's apartment. And they lived in a brownstone, an apartment building on the first floor. And I should tell you about Bundy that a lot of people think that Bundy's victims were either hitchhikers or somebody, something just presented itself and then he grabbed them. Those would be crimes of opportunity, and they did happen. But Bundy himself said that many of the abductions, or you know, a lot of times what he would do, he would see women walking, he would follow them to their apartment, and then he would kind of stalk them and kind of keep track of them. Well, anyway, so one day, it was still light out, but I think it was heading towards like dinner. Frida Aid and what is the other lady's name? It'll come out in the book. They had originally come from Jacksonville, Florida, and came to Salt Lake in that summer, like maybe July. And they moved into this brownstone, and it had like several floors. But they said they got a knock on the door, and they opened it up, and it was later the man that they would later identify as Ted Bundy. And he was classic Bundy. He was classic. He would say always things like this. He would say things to people, excuse me, miss, or, oh, I'm sorry to bother you, miss, but could you help me with this? So he says, I'm sorry. I don't mean to bother you all. He said, I'm a law student at the University of Utah, and there's a woman here that is in the class, like with me. And, you know, he said, I borrowed her notes. I'm trying to get them back to her. Well, he described this woman, and they both, even though they didn't know her name, they pretty much recognized who he was talking about. And so he couldn't tell her what apartment she lived in because he said, we don't know. We know who you're talking about, but we can't tell you because we don't know her name, but she lives here. So she said, I remember Frida A told me, she said, do you want me to, you want to give me the notes and I'll, you know, when I see her, I'll hand them to her, because they used to see her a lot. In fact, I think she told Bundy she's a telephone operator, and they kind of pass each other all the time. When Frida Aid and her friend is coming home from work, she's usually heading out. But Bundy said, no, I'll see her in class tomorrow, and I will give those notes to her then. And I said, Frida, can you remember when this was? She said, well, I can tell you it was before the October murders, which is really when they really started. She said, so it would be like maybe like late September, somewhere through there. But she said she was very specific. She said, but it was before the October murders. And she said later when she, after she saw his car, that she had, and he had been identified like a year later as a suspect in the crimes there. She said she remembers seeing his car parked about, because apparently being on the first floor, I think she spotted it right out on the street. So he pulled up. So see, he had been stalking that lady. And, I was able to, as busy as he was, I was able to determine that he was already forming a hunting pattern in basically what was his own backyard, right there, right close to his apartment. And not more than, in this case, five blocks, not more than three blocks from Susan Milner. And you, I can guarantee you there were others that we just don't know about. But the bottom line is, no one knew that until then. The first sign we have of Bundy, wherever he admitted to murder, was with Nancy Wilcox, which was October 2nd of 1974. And she wouldn't even be on the investigator, because they never found her body. She wouldn't be on the investigator's radar as a possible Bundy victim till way down the road, when they started to see all these other murders. So, but anyway, now, by doing that, I also busted a myth that had been around and is still around for a long time. There is talk that Bundy knew Laura and Amy prior to the murders.
Okay.
And it's in the record. And I know that I would love to have talked to Richard Larson. He was, I'm sure, a great guy, and he wrote The Deliberate Stranger. But Larson kind of, you know, he was on board with this, that Bundy knew her. But if you go to the record, it tells about the times and the circumstances of these. And now that we know what we know about where Bundy was hunting that first month, it's just not possible. So, I mean, I can explain here, but apparently this, of course, when I first learned of this, when I was writing the Bundy murders, no matter how much I studied it or investigated it, I never felt good about it. So I left it out of the book. During the trail of Ted Bundy, because I would hear people talk about this, I at least presented it in the book. And I said, look, I'm not saying it can't be true. It very well may be true, but it didn't feel good to me when I wrote the Bundy murders, and it doesn't feel good to me now. And yet I'll present the story. Well, if you look at the record, just imagine this. Bundy had moved to Salt Lake City, which is a pretty large city. This myth has him going about 30 miles south to little tiny Lehi, Utah, which has at the time had about 4,300 or 4,600 people there, a very small town. And according to this myth, he was going down there, and this is in the record. Mm-hmm. He was going down there, and he would stay at the place. He would come and go from a place called Brown's Cafe. It wasn't the actual name of the place. It was the nickname that the kids gave it. And apparently, according to what people have testified, that he would come in there and he became friends with some of the guys there. And he became friends with Laura and Amy and spent some time there. And all of this, according to the record, had to be in that, you know, that end of summer, early fall period, like September, right through there. Well, it turns out that for him to have gone down there to this tiny town and be there enough that he's striking up friendships with guys and hanging out there a lot and getting to know Laura and Amy, it just couldn't happen. He was just too busy that month, because now we have a hunting pattern. He's out hunting for women actively in his own area during the same month, which he didn't even arrive there until the 3rd, and then went home for a while in the middle of the month.
No.
So, and getting moved in and dealing with school. So that's another myth busted. So I can conclusively say now it didn't happen. Now, I also want to say this.
Okay.
I'm not saying these people lied. I don't believe that for a second. And I know another Bundy investigator, and I agree on this.
Can I ask you a quick question, though, Kevin?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you suppose that the reason that myth stuck around for so long was because Bundy would take some of the, and I know I'm jumping ahead in the story here, but because Bundy did have a pattern of taking body parts far away and doing things with them, that it wasn't out of the realm of possibility that maybe and just maybe he would travel to kill somebody as well?
He would travel to kill somebody, but because we've established his hunting pattern for that first month, that he was right there in his own neighborhood and he was also busy doing other things, the likelihood in this case where he would go so far south every day, every other day, but a lot, going down there a lot to become friends with these people, hang out with these people, meet Laura and Amy, hang out with her. It just didn't happen. Now, what I think and what another Bundy investigator thinks, we both believe it was misidentification. They identified Bundy later. The guy could have been a guy with long hair driving a Volkswagen Beetle of light brown or beige. Could have been. The chances for it being Bundy, I just think, are absolutely zero. As far as Bundy doing things, as far in Washington State, and this is the bodies per se, in Washington State, he had two different dumping grounds. And he did admit to at one time having four heads in his Washington State apartment on 12th Street or 12th Avenue in Seattle. And he had lived there for a number of years, a good number of years, actually. So he had had four heads up there at one time. Now, were they fleshed out heads? Some, and then other skulls, we don't know. But we do know that four skulls were found on Taylor Mountain and a few debris of other bones, which come the 2007, I think, were finally identified as the other missing women. But the bodies were never found. And here's what's interesting about that. He said, the bodies I buried were never found. But those I left on the ground were a lot of times found. And so he buried those bodies somewhere, probably on Taylor Mountain, and maybe some predators were able to unearth like a leg bone or something like that, but not the whole bodies. But he dumped these four skulls on there on Taylor Mountain, and they were later discovered. I don't know why he just didn't take a shovel, spend about 15 or 20 minutes digging a decent size, you know, fairly small hole, but enough to carry four skulls, put four skulls in, cover it up, and they'd never be found, because he buried George Ann Hawkins' skull about 50 feet after he'd taken her head and used it for a while for nefarious and perhaps, of course, sexual purposes. Who knows? He buried that on a hillside in Issaquah, and that's never been located. I mean, they tried to locate it. But they found in the Issaquah dump site, that's where they found the remains of Janice Ott, but no skull. Then George Ann Hawkins, they didn't know who that was until after Bundy confessed it at his death row confession. But that was George Ann Hawkins. He said, I buried her head on a hillside. Keppel and his people went back following Bundy's directions, and it just the topography had changed enough to where they don't know. It's just they couldn't locate it. So, and then, of course, and the other woman was Denise Naslin, and they did find, you know, most of her body and then her bones and then the skull. So he would do things, and he would take like heads home, and he would do stuff. But I don't think he would. I think we can finally say conclusively that he certainly was hunting that first month he was there in his own little environment, and he was right there in practically his own neighborhood before he started branching out and got Nancy Wilcox on the 2nd of October. And that's why there isn't any way in the world he could have been so far down in tiny Lehigh. I mean, I can't imagine Bundy wanting to become known in a small town.
Yeah.
But, you know, still though, it just wasn't him. So that was another bit. And so Catherine Ramsland, she and I are personal friends. She always blurbs my book. She's just a great lady. Has had a great career as a professor and true crime writer. And anyway, she said, and this is really, I like how she said that, because it's true. it's just that this volume shows that we can still chip away at his secrets. And it's true. It's amazing. Certain things that will still come to light.
That
and
is
this
true.
Is one of them. And that other Bundy researcher I know, he's got a book coming out, and he's brought to light some attempted murders that Bundy did attempted it, you know, abduction and murder, but that they failed. Anyway, there's still stuff we can find out. So it's just really cool to be able to bring it out. And every time I pull up a companion volume, it's got new information in it. Just really cool.
Very cool. I tell you what, at this point, Kevin, let's take our break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about in the early years, why such bravado to pull off these crimes so close to home? We'll tackle that. The other thing I want to tackle, too, is how to separate fact from fiction. When you get these stories, like you've mentioned, this other researcher is gathering these stories, too. How to separate what could be an authentic Bundy encounter from what may have been somebody thinking they had a Bundy encounter. We'll tackle that as well. Our guest is Kevin Sullivan, and I want you to check out the book, folks, because it is intriguing. There's a lot of good stuff in here. The book is Ted Bundy, The Yearly Journal, and it's year one, pretty much. So it's available right now. We've got a link in the description of our program here. It is put out by Wild Blue Press, and you can get it also on Amazon.com, but we've got a link right in the description of this program. We want you to go out and get that book right now, especially if you're what we like to call a Bundyphile. If you like to get out there and get as much information on Ted Bundy as you can, there's lots of good stuff in here. And Kevin has really put some hard work into this book in compiling more Bundy information for you. Like we said, if this is a yearly event, that's a lot of stuff. When we come back, more with Kevin Sullivan. We'll talk more Bundy right after this on the Best in True Crime Podcasting, True Crime Tuesday.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Welcome back to the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest is Kevin Sullivan, the author of 6 books on Ted Bundy. This is his 7th, Ted Bundy, The Yearly Journal, Volume 1, 2022. And it's available at wildbluepress.com, also available on amazon.com. We'll have a link to it in the description of this program to make it easy for you to go ahead and order that book. Kevin, before the break, I had teased that we're going to get a little bit into the psychology of, in those early years of Ted Bundy, why hunt so close to home, you know, to suggest that you're willing to go within 5 blocks, 6 blocks, a mile, mile and a half of where you're living and commit these murders. Some people would say, well, Tim, that's easy pickings. You know, you can just, you can do it and get away with it. But really, psychologically, that suggests, you know what, I can do anything I want and get away with it. That's a bravado and a whole new level of narcissism that is hard to comprehend. Why did Bundy feel like, especially early in his career, he could get away with it?
Well, that's an interesting question. When you think at certain crimes Bundy committed, certain ways about which he would perform his abductions, a normal mind would say, no, you don't want to do that. For example, when he went to Lake Sammamish on July 14th of 1974, he was talking to these women. He used his real name, at least his first name, Ted, to a couple of them, and led some to his car, but they didn't go with him because they couldn't leave. But he was doing things very boldly, and in front of, you know, like at Lake Sammamish that day, there was like 40,000 people, and the police department was actually having a party at the park. So Bundy just felt immune to that. Or if you look at what he did at Dumont High School, he went into an auditorium, was seen by hundreds of people, and there were 1,500 people there. And he presented himself to them, and he sought someone out and finally was able to grab Debbie Kent as she left early to go pick up her brother from a roller rink. Well, why would one do that? Normal minds would say, well, you know what? You don't want to be seen by anybody. But yet, you know, that he's not normal. Now, he would say, you don't ever want to be seen leading a woman into the car, but apparently it didn't bother him. It would have bothered me or you or somebody else, for example, to be hunting women at between 11 p.m. and midnight on June 11th, 1974, while you're in an area that people can know you, and you're hobbling on crutches with a leg cast and fumbling with a briefcase in an area where anybody that you know could spot you in the hub of your life, which is Seattle. He was it. Okay. But yet he did it. And Bundy was so successful at pulling the unthinkable off. That night he was able to get, George Ann Hawkins. You know, he started on June 10th up until 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. It passed into past midnight. Then it was June 11th. And here comes, you know, around 12:30 or 1 o'clock, George Ann Hawkins, and he got her. So you would think he would have been afraid to be seen by somebody and then for a report to come forth, but apparently not. Incidentally, in a case like that, 2 weeks before George Ann Hawkins, he was hunting in the same area, Creek Row, and he, again, asked a woman for help. He was fumbling with, a briefcase. He had crutches. She followed him to his car, his VW. It might have been parked in the same lot about a block away where he took George Ann Hawkins that night. But he said, I don't know why, but sometimes this happened. He said he got to the car with her, and all of a sudden he didn't want to kill her. For some reason, he didn't want to kill her. Now, he didn't explain why. It was rare when this happened. And I only know of this thing and another incident where he, he was in his reformation period with this other lady, and he decided he wouldn't kill her either. But But the bottom line is he let her go. And then he thought, oh, my God, after the George Ann Hawkins abduction, he said, if this woman goes to the police and says, well, there was this guy that I helped to his car. He was fumbling with a briefcase or books or whatever, hobbling on crutches, and he drives a beige VW. And Bundy had also told her, I live in the university district. So he said, they might be able to catch me. So he was horrified that he had not killed her, really, and allowed her to go, even though he wanted to let her go, and he did. He thinks, boy, this thing could bounce back on me. But outside of those times where it seemed like his reasoning was working properly, many of the things he did in the way of abduction and murder were so astounding, they just were past people believing after he heard about it. I mean, if you look at the abduction of Linda Ann Healy, and I've said this on some of these documentaries I've been on, but if you look at what he did, how he got Linda Ann Healy, I've never heard of a more bizarre abduction and bold abduction in my life. And I don't think I ever will hear. And here's what he did with her. There were these co-eds that lived in this house in the university district. Mm-hmm. And he had tried the front door and found it to be unlocked. He probably knew some of the women there, not know them per se, but he probably knew of them. He certainly knew the number to the house, but he told a writer, he said, when I found out the door was unlocked, I didn't go in then. I wanted to wait until the middle of the night. Well, here's what he did. He goes in there, likely that very same night, and he goes down into the basement. And as he goes down the basement steps, there's a door off to the left that goes out to the on the side of the house, and it's just about 5 feet from where you turn the corner to the front of the house and go down the steps. And he passed those steps, walked down the steps. When you get to the end of the steps, you turn right. There's three more steps, and then what you have in the bottom, it's just a basement that was made into a two apartment area. And so he went into the door straight across from there. Think of this. He's aware that there's another woman sleeping on the other side, separated by a small partition of plywood, but they're actual rooms. Everybody's got their own room down there, those two. So anyway, he goes in there, and there's Linda Ann Healy sleeping. Now, some people think she was bludgeoned, but I don't think so at all, for two reasons. You don't see any real blood spatter in a room from the crime scene photos. What you do see is blood flow. And when Bundy was explaining what he did and why the blood was there, he told this writer, he said, well, you have to understand a little bit of the physiology of like a nosebleed and how that can start from choking. So apparently he jumped on her and immediately, she's asleep, started choking her. She had to have awakened to that, obviously, but she couldn't make a sound, and he choked her into unconsciousness. Then he does the most bizarre thing. You would think that he'd do whatever he wants to do with the woman there and then leave. Right. He doesn't do that. He either puts her on the floor or in a chair. The blood had come out of her nose and gone on to the back of her nightgown. He hung the nightgown up in the closet, and then he took the pillowcase off, but he made, because it had a good amount of blood on it, but he made the bed, not in any way Linda ever made it. In fact, she didn't even make the bed through the week because she had to be at her job as a radio ski announcer early, like at 6:30 a.m., so she would get up and grab something, maybe a breakfast bar or something, and then she'd get on her bicycle and go. So she never made the bed. So not only did he take the time to make the bed in like a military fashion in a way that she couldn't or wouldn't, but he also grabbed a backpack and some clothes, and then he walked her up the steps, probably wrapped her in a blanket. She was unconscious. And he went out into the night. He went out that side door. Now, we don't know if he went down, took a right, and went down the front steps to his car. He may very well have done that. as odd as that seems, he may have done that, or he may have gone out the back. There's no, I've been there, of course, there's no gate on the back fence. He could have kind of laid her over, and then he'd have to drop her on the ground and then hop the fence. But if he parked back there, it's so narrow, that alley, he would he'd almost block it. But there is an alcove a few houses down where he could have pulled in there. So he could have gone out either way. The fact that he's carrying something that is unmistakably a body or someone unconscious, whatever, it's a human, out into a university district in the middle of the night where, you know how college kids are. They might be coming home from something.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all kinds of windows, anything. But this stuff didn't bother him, but it would bother someone normal. But then again, we are not a homicidal psychopath. So, you know, he just was, for the most part, Bundy felt impervious to fear. And that's the thing about this. That's what made, that's one of the things that stand out with him. It just, how can a guy that is so educated, well-educated, articulate, handsome, he's so diabolical. But anyway, he got her, got into his car, and of course she must have awakened, as, and I'm sure he liked that because he liked women to then experience the fear. And then he did what he had, not what he had to do, but he did what he does, and then might have had sex with her before, but certainly had sex with her after death, because of course he's a necrophile. And he, in fact, an admitted necrophile, but he just didn't like to talk about it very often. So anyway, he was just bold. I think he felt impervious to fear. And that's why he was doing these things that most people would think, oh my God, if I was that way, I would never do that. But he didn't mind. And I think that's one of the reasons that makes Bundy stand out from a lot of other serial killers. I mean, I just think if you look at Bundy, I think Bundy has become to the United States what Jack the Ripper, became to England long ago. I think they're both the premier killers of their countries, of the countries in which they killed. And when you think serial murder, the first person that comes into your mind, or at least almost the first, would be Ted Bundy. So it just, and I think the reason for that is because of how bold he was. Just women that would just disappear, just mysteriously disappear. Out of almost like it seems out of nowhere, just by having an encounter with this man.
Yeah. I want to address something that you and Dave also brought up, because it comes up again in this book as well. And it's in one respect a little thinly veiled, and in another it's not. And that is that he refers to the beast within him. But then people also refer to physical changes they see within him. And it's sprinkled throughout this book, seeing him red-faced and seeing his face almost transmorph, seeing the rage within him and seeing him almost transform. And that it keeps being brought up in case after case after case, almost like he loses himself and he becomes something other than what he was. They describe charming and then all of a sudden going to another place. And I know Dave had brought it up before, and he had brought up the theory of maybe Bundy was possessed, that maybe there was an otherworldly dimension to Bundy. And the reason I bring this up is I thought more about it as I was sitting and reading this book this past weekend. We have a friend, a mutual friend, who is a psychologist in the jail system, and she's also a psychic. And she said, I would get in huge trouble with the court system and the jail system if they knew, if I brought up the psychic stuff and said, I could tell the difference between who may have some mental deficiencies and who actually may be possessed. But she says it's not hard to tell the difference between the two. And I wonder, when you sit back, having dealt with as much as you've dealt with here, Kevin, and I guess I'm not asking for a clinical view here, but maybe more of a layman's point of view. When you take a look at it, is it possible that there's a combination of maybe mental illness and maybe a little of the supernatural here? Because it seems to me that it's almost like Ted Bundy did go out of body and to extremes that no other human could go to.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, as you know, I am a, semi-retired minister, but I've dealt a lot with things with the supernatural and stuff like that. And I never talk about demons or supernatural things in my true crime books, but I think Ted Bundy had things in him that he cultivated over a period of time. But I see in the Bundy murders when it's talked about the entity or the force that he had, I said there, he was never a powerless pawn. It's not how that works, but that he had cultivated these very dark things over a long period of time. And so if there are things out there, which I know there are, when you are cultivating this and a human is heading towards that, there are certainly those entities who will come in and help energize you to do those deeds. Now, I can tell you, I never met Bundy, but I've had a lot of dealings with people that have had problems in areas, including those who have murdered people. And there's certain things about them, and you can see certain things erupt. And you can see when you're counseling and ministering to somebody and performing what we call deliverance, the Catholic Church would call exorcism, you can see a various things happen, supernatural things happen. But putting that aside and just going on what has been told about Bundy, I know that the writer Stephen Michaud said on one of these documentaries, and I mean, I know Michaud. In fact, I ran into him in Knoxville last week on an elevator. We were both there to do a Bundy documentary, and so we ran into each other at the hotel in the elevator. He said, that was weird that we ran in together to each other like this. I said, I know, it's surreal, isn't it? And then we laughed about that. But Michaud said that he was talking about one of the murders to Bundy, and this is when Bundy was answering things in the third person, years before his death row confessions, where he came out and said, I did this, I did that. He said, Bundy took the recorder I had, brought it very close to him, and it said, it looked like he went into a trance. And he said, as I watched him, something very weird happened. He said, I saw this welt start to form on his cheek. It came out, this white-looking welt, and then it kind of lengthened and kept going on his cheek. And just some kind of physical reaction that was odd that you wouldn't think happened. But again, this was during this like trance-like state. And then, of course, after it resolved, and then Bundy kind of came back to himself, that thing disappeared. I also know that, there were a number of people who were there with Bundy, but when he had been arrested and they couldn't find the body of young Kimberly Leach, which turned out to be his last victim, a 12-year-old that he had murdered in Lake City, Florida, they had him a couple months before they found that body. But when the news came to Bundy, when Bundy heard about it from somebody in a group he was with his, there were some investigators there, like I think for the defense, and there was his attorneys there. There was about five guys there. And they said Bundy, when he heard that her body had been discovered, they said, it's like he started to morph into something else. They said his body seemed to change. His muscle tone changed. There was a very bad smell. It started emanating out of him. And they're not talking about like he passed gas. But his body was morphing into something else. And, of course, that to me, that speaks of something that's happening within the person. Right. Also, there, Liz Kendall had two incidents with Bundy. One when right before the 1974 murders, he was starting to change his sexual desires with her, and he had asked her for anal intercourse, and she didn't want to do that, but he asked to tie her up. So she said, I let him do that a couple of times, but I soon put a stop to that too. She said, so once when we were having sex, he put his hands around my throat, and he was choking me, and I couldn't. She said she looked at his face. It's like his face was not. He wasn't seeing her, and she had to kind of like hit on him or something to finally break that spell, to where he came to and he stopped.
Mm.
Well, and also they were out once on the Yakima River. Now this is a week before the Lake Sammamish murders, and he goes out on the Yakima with her. Beautiful day, and they're traveling down the Yakima, and they're taking a trip that's probably going to take them, you know, 5 hours or something. They brought lunch with them. Well, apparently, according to Liz, it started out okay. She certainly was in a good mood, but she said the longer we went, he started to become more quiet. And then they pulled up to the shore, or maybe even on the little island, I can't remember. But they got on the shore, they got on land, and they had a lunch there, and, you know, maybe they talked a little, but mostly he wasn't talking. And they had like a beer and sandwich, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they got back in. But before an hour was out, as they traveled down the Yakima, out of nowhere, he pushed her into the water. And she came up gasping, and she looked at him, and she said his face was blank. She said, here again, it's like he wasn't seeing me. It's like he wasn't there. And this is what his victim saw. And, you know, then he came to, and pulled her back in the raft. Well, I say in the book, the Bundy murders, when she saw that and his face was blank and it didn't look like he was seeing her, I said, the killer is now with her.
Yeah.
And I said, it's probably all he could do to rein that beast back inside of himself. So these things that happened to him, I know that you and I would call somebody like Bundy crazy. Now, I know I've been on the show before when I talked about, you know, Richard Chase, the vampire of Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Richard Chase was truly a crazy person. I mean, in ways that Bundy was not. He believed that somebody had moved like a valve of his heart, that his blood was turning to powder. He really believed this stuff. So he wasn't legally insane. That's why he went on trial for murder and was convicted. But he was. Definitely, and the prosecution admitted this, that Richard Chase was deeply mentally ill, but he wasn't legally insane. Well, they don't consider Bundy deeply mentally ill, but any man that wants to strangle a woman to death and cut off her head and have oral sex with it back in the apartment, or do any number of necrophilic things, I mean, you know, we're going to call them as crazy as a... you know what, rat. I mean, they're just bad crazy. I mean, but now they're not legally crazy. So, I mean, was Bundy mentally ill to a point? Yeah, I think so. I think more than that, I think he had turned himself over to evil and he had picked up things which helped drove him in that direction. Bundy did admit this. He said, and I've known these other killers that I've read about have said the same thing. A lot of times when, you know, Bundy would say the desire to kill would rise, and he would get into, you know, of course, I don't know if he'd call it an altered state, but that's what it was. And then after he'd commit the murder, then it would subside again. And Bundy used to refer that as coming back to his normal self. So he recognized something was going on there, that it would both rise and fall. And in fact, the other woman that I talked about that Bundy let go, he laughed to Michelle. He said, well, it was in my reformation period. And there was nothing actively going on with me. Now, he said, if this would have happened like maybe 3 weeks later, yeah, I absolutely would have killed her. But there was nothing actively going on. So he said he picked this girl up. They went someplace. They were drinking together, laughing, having sex together, and it was all mutual. And he said, even without that thing rising, he said, I just want to see if I can do all this with her, and not kill her. But you could tell as he talked that there were starting to be some desires there that he kind of wanted to kill her, but no, he was going to show that he didn't have to kill her. So, but he came out and said, if this would have happened weeks later, when that thing had like risen up in him, that she would be dead meat. So you can see he knew he was dealing with something. And some people like to poo-poo and kind of reject that thing about, you know, the entity. But it's very real. And for whatever reason and whatever the cause was, it would rise up in Bundy and he would recognize it when it was there, and then it would go back down. And when he said, I would become myself again. Of course, he's still a murdering self, obviously.
Right.
But he's talking about the power that was there to do that. Also, another thing Bundy did, Bundy would drink a lot to get himself into that state of murder when he knew he was hunting. When I wrote the Bundy Secrets, I mentioned that woman to you, Carol Bartholomew.
Mm-hmm.
But she gave me this woman's name, and her name is Louise Cannon. And Louise Cannon knew Bundy, and Louise Cannon was a woman that Bundy did not want to murder. He just wanted to date. And Louise Cannon worked in a bank just a couple blocks from his house when he left 565 First Avenue and moved in Salt Lake City. He moved over to, I think, at 320 Douglas Avenue, but it's on Douglas Avenue. It's about two blocks catty corner, as they say, from this bank. Well, Bundy used to come in this bank all the time, and he always wanted to see Louise. And then he would come over, like when there was snow, he would come over and he would wipe the snow off the car when she left the teller portion, and everybody went home for the evening. She would stay for like another hour and work the drive-through, and he would come over and clean her car off. And he asked her one night, "Can you want to walk down the alley to the coffee shop?" And she did. Well, she was always kind of jovial, Ted, right? Well, she said that on the evening of October 18th of 1974, she walked into a bar called the Widow McCoy's, and there's still a Widow McCoy's in Salt Lake City, Utah, but it's several blocks from the original one where she was. And she said she walked in, and she was supposedly two of her girlfriends there. And sure enough, there they were at the table. But she looked over, and there was Bundy at the bar sitting there by himself, sipping, not a beer, but like, bourbon or vodka or something. And he was sipping on hard liquor. But she said it was odd because he was not his talkative self. And all he did was he looked at her and he said, "Hey, Louise, how you doing?" She said, "Fine, Ted, how are you?" And that was about it. At any other time, he would have started chatting her up. Well, she said she walked over to the table, sat down with her friends. And she said, the next time I looked over, he was gone. Now, she knew this was a preset time to go there. It was October 18th. Well, this was about 8:30, I think, when she noticed him gone. Later, it would come out that was the night, within a couple of hours, that he abducted Melissa Smith.
Oh.
And this had never come out before. And I asked Louise, I said, "Louise, has anybody ever talked to you about this before? Any writers?" She said, "No. In fact, outside of a couple of detectives interviewing me when this happened, no." She said, "You're the first one." Well, again, she doesn't bandy this information about, but she knows Carol Bartholomew very well, and they're both valid Bundy contacts. Well, anyway, so what Bundy did was he was liquoring himself up. He was jump-starting himself because he was going to be hunting that night. And sure enough, a few blocks away from there was a place called the Pepperoni Pizza. And that's where Melissa had gone to see one of her friends that night. And later, the person identified, it might not be valid, but it could very well be, that Bundy was in there when Melissa was there and then likely left soon after she left. Now, he either picked her up and drove her like from there, offered a ride, but more likely, I think the more likely explanation is he followed her and maybe got ahead of her because she had to walk home past like a school where the lighting wasn't very bright, and there was a woman. This is really weird. It was close to like 10:30 at night or something, close to 11 o'clock at night. And she's out raking leaves, and she hears a female scream. This was one loud scream, pierced the night air. And so because of that, I think Bundy, what he did was he probably went ahead of her and then jumped out from behind his car. And she saw he had a crowbar, and he whacked her in the head and then abducted her. And it was terrible, because it's always terrible. But when you think about this, this is she was the daughter of the chief of police of Midvale, Utah. Chief Lewis Smith. He was long dead before I wrote my book. But I had all these dealings with Jerry Thompson and interviewing him and calling him on the phone, all that stuff. And he was good friends with Lewis, Chief Smith. And later, Chief Smith just couldn't handle it. He turned the investigation over to Jerry. But all this came out from Louise Cannon. So this was another thing that came out. And so it's another piece of the puzzle. We had no idea what Bundy was doing or where he was before he got Melissa Smith. But now we know he was in the Widow McCoy's drinking and doing that elixir thing to help him jumpstart him. And he was seen by Louise Cannon. In fact, Louise Cannon's family owned that bank and a couple of others in Salt Lake. And when they heard about this, what Bundy had done, suspected of doing, they would transfer her around to different banks or whatever. And he, Bundy called her one day and said, "Well, I just don't know where you are." And again, he had no intention of hurting her. He just thought he would kind of, she's one of these women he wanted to develop a relationship with, but not harm. So these are the kind of stories that have come out over the years. And it's just, I'm glad as a historian, that's what I am at heart, to get this stuff down on the printed page for future readers and researchers.
Right. And bizarre when you mention that relationship, because it's not a love relationship. I don't think he was capable of it, but just no. in a, I want you for safekeeping, or I want you for my own uses. Just bizarre. Yeah. And kind of wrapping up here, Kevin, I got one last question here, and that is, in the title of this book, it's Ted Bundy, The Yearly Journal, suggesting that there's more out here and more to be searched through. So I've got to throw this out here, and I know this is on the top of our listeners' minds as well. Uh-huh. And that is, you're suggesting that Bundy was more prolific than what is there. And I know in the book you mentioned that there had to have been a solid 30 to mid-30s as far as killings went. But potentially there could be more, 40, maybe 45. So how do you, as an author, as a researcher, how do you sift a solid Bundy story from something that may be either mistaken or just plain out hogwash? Mm-hmm. How do you kind of sift that out through the wash?
Yeah, that's good. That's good. There's several things I look for when some people contact me. They give me where they were and the times in which they were there. And a lot of times, and this would be throughout even different states. And then I would say, well, from the record, we know that couldn't be Bundy because he wasn't there at that time. So, and they go, oh, okay. But even then some women would say, no, it was him. It was him. Well, it wasn't him. He wasn't there. Then also sometimes I'm contacted by people with these elaborate stories, and they don't always have the ring of truth to them. Mm-hmm. And, they say they're from a certain area or whatever, but when I do a little bit of investigation, I'm not sure, I'm on the fence. And so a lot of those I won't publish. And then sometimes they become so absurd, and there's other things I do find out about them that I just, in my mind, I know, no, they weren't. But here's what's really curious. And a lot of women would say they saw this guy later after he was arrested, and then they would remember that he tried to pick him up. And their stories weren't elaborate. They're just very brief. And there wasn't much to them. He pulled up beside me, or he rolled the window down and said this. And I said, oh, I can't. And then he said this, and he was driving a beige Volkswagen, but that's it. In fact, since you got an advanced reader copy on that book, you'll notice that One woman contacted me who said she had an encounter with who she absolutely believed was Bundy, but it was not in 1974 where he went down to Oregon State University and got Kathy Parks. It was in either 73 or 75, but I think she said 73. Well, it had been so many years since I had studied the original files of certain things. I'd forgotten that Bundy admitted killing two in Oregon. And everything she said had the ring of truth to it. But when she told me it wasn't 1974, I said, well, it just can't be him. And see, here's another sign that's valid. She goes, oh, well, I sure thought so because it really looked like him. But okay, well, thanks for telling me. And I didn't keep any of her information and had to give everything in the book by memory. But when women contact me and say, well, you know, there wasn't a lot to it, but let me tell you what happened. And they're in the right area at the right time when he was there. Even though there's not 100% proof, it becomes highly, highly likely. And you'll notice from the book, I talk about sets of numbers of what it could be for contacting people, like attempting them an abduction, but they didn't know that it was an attempted abduction, just trying to get women to follow him. Even though he might have had 35 to 45, some say maybe 50. I don't believe it goes higher than that, but let's just say in the late 40s, the mid 40s, you could have as many as 10 people, if not more, that he would try to coax to go with him before he got somebody. And if you start doing that, even like 10 times, you're up to 350 to 400 valid contacts, whether they knew it or not. In fact, Bundy himself said, when he finally got committed, when this is the end of my confession, when he went up to Pocatello on May 5th of 1975 and hunted women at the university there, and he didn't get anybody either that day or night. And in my research, I found out one of the reasons why is because even though it was in May, they were still having a lot of cold weather and there were snow showers on both days he was there, both on the 5th and the 6th of May. Well, any woman going to and fro, if they see somebody hobbling, I'm sorry, I can't do it. They're freezing.
Yeah.
And so anyway, but he said, after he admitted to killing Culver on the 6th, they asked him, they said, were there any other incidents? He said, well, none that would be noticed would have been noticed by any of the women. In other words, the abduction failed before it could really turn into something that would start raising the suspicions of the women that I was talking to. So in other words, he was saying there was a lot others really I've tried to get. If you look at it, he must have tried a lot on that May 6th during the day. And I mean, May 5th during the day and during the evening. And he had to go back to his hotel room. He thought he would go back to his hotel room with a victim. And yet he went back home empty handed. So only God knows how many people tried to contact. So there could be 400 or more people out there that are, you know, valid Bundy contacts. So I try to screen people the best I can. I find out where they're living now, a lot of times, where they were living then, what happened, other people that maybe can corroborate what, you know, where they were or, you know, what's been said. And it just, you know, so in some things I say, it certainly seems like Bundy. It could very well be Bundy. And then there's times I say it absolutely is Bundy. And then when you take contacts like, well, Andrew Valdez, who was a friend of his and is well known, all the things he told me, Louise Cannon, Carol Bartholomew, Larry Alexander, John Homer, and people that had guard over him in jail and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it's just, you know, all those are, you know, just 100%. So I only publish those things which I really feel there's enough qualifiers for it to be a valid Bundy contact. Could somebody kind of take me out on some of them? I guess it's possible, but I try to go after it from so many angles that, if worse comes to worse, I say, this is what happened. this is what she said. She believes it's Bundy, and it could very well likely it could be him. So I let people judge for themselves. And other times they'll say, no, this was Bundy. So that's how they come about. So there's a lot of them I have to let go. And there's a number of them that, I've got one now for next year's book. This woman is a retired circuit court judge. And she had this incident with a person she believes was Bundy, and he was driving a beige Volkswagen. Is it absolutely Bundy? I don't know, but I'm like, from everything she told me, like about 98% sure. So, and she's got a police report on it too, and I have to get that. But, so just interesting stuff, you know, and that's how this stuff comes about.
Very interesting indeed. And like the book says, if you try to take his ratios into effect, it could be, you know, 4 to 5 contacts to 7 to 8 contacts to every one he succeeded at. I mean, it's staggering as to when he was, as you put it, hunting, how many approaches he made as to when he was actually successful. So, you may have enough material, my friend, to go 10, 20 volumes deep in your yearly journal, still have stories.
As long as I have breath, as long as I'm able to write, as long as people contacted me, I'm going to try to get it down on the printed page, because I think it's, you know, a lot of people are leaving, have left, that have been a part of that case. And once all the voices are still that were a part of it, then that's it. So yeah. I just want to keep getting more out there with that if that's possible. So that's what I'll do.
Oh, absolutely. And you can, folks, right now go out and get Ted Bundy, the Yearly Journal, Volume 1, 2022. We have a link for it in the description of this program. Again, it's available at wildbluepress.com, also available on amazon.com. But the simplest thing, just click the link right there in the description of the show. Kevin Sullivan, I want to thank you very much for joining us again here on True Crime Tuesday.
Oh, thanks, Tim. I appreciate it. We'll see you next time.
Thank you so much, Kevin. All right, it's a time where if you're listening to the free version of the show, we must bid you adieu. But if you don't want to leave us right now, you don't necessarily have to. What you can do is you can go to Stitcher.com, click on the subscribe button under Stitcher Premium. That will get you to listen to Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. That'll get you to listen to the ad-free version of Darkness Radio. And that'll get you to listen to hundreds of podcasts ad-free and expand your audio horizons more than you could possibly ever imagine. And the best thing is you can do it for just $5 a month. Do it right now. Go to Stitcher.com, click on that premium button, subscribe to Stitcher Premium for just $5 a month. You'll get Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals as far as True Crime Tuesday. You'll get an ad-free Darkness Radio. And of course, you'll get hundreds of podcasts ad-free and expand those audio horizons. Go ahead and do it today.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code iHeart or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code iHeart or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code iHeart or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.